A cross, a crucifix, a tree. These varied images of Christian passion are richly textured with emotion and form the cornerstone of Christian piety. The cross itself, emblematic of deep feelings, ironically can be used as a sign of rage and disconnection. I remember as a 13-year-old teenager in the mid-60s, growing up in Erie, Pennsylvania, when my family moved into a newly developed suburban neighborhood to promote the cause of integration. We were the first black family in the area, and I was the only African-American kid in my junior high school. We had heard rumors that neighbors were buying guns for self-protection, dreading the arrival of a black family to their community. A week or so after moving in, we woke up in the middle of the night, jolted by the sound of a rock crashing through our living room window. We all rushed to the room and witnessed a cross burning on our front yard. After that cross burning, we were frenzied. My father bought a pistol to protect our family. I had never actually seen a gun before. And we spent several sleepless nights huddled together. That event stained my emotional associations to the cross. It was tinged in fear rather than painted in redemption. In my forced social isolation from that community in which we lived, I was able to find a group of kids who were similarly socially rejected. At that time, my neighborhood and the city were also profoundly anti-Semitic, and so my family and I hung out with the Jewish kids and their families. Many of us can be stuck, as I was, in the moment of the burning cross, those agonizing times when God seems at best far away and at worst dead or non-existent. I know that event colored my sense of personal safety and, more profoundly, affected my attitude toward Christianity and the symbol of the cross. I think that the cross became literally a psychological sign of impending threat. Afterwards, viewing the cross caused me anxiety and a desire to flee from its compass. I no longer have such an active aversion to the symbol, but I know that the event had a deep influence on my theology and my ethics. I cannot call myself Christian, not because of the moving and prophetic biblical texts, but because of its all-consuming symbol of suffering and violence. I believe that Martin Luther King Jr. redeemed us through his ethos of nonviolence and has rescued the virtue of peace that roars through his voice, drowning out the clamor of bigotry and domination.
After hearing Roy's powerful testimony, let us remember to breathe and to simply be present to the difficult emotions. Today, I'd like to make an invitation for us to ground ourselves in this broad historical context. And let us consider how we may be a part of the events occurring in our world this weekend. today in private quarters, and then tomorrow publicly, we will inaugurate our first African-American U.S. president for a second term, which is likely an even more significant occurrence than the fact that we elected a black man the first time. Now, 4 years later, making a powerful, definitive choice, we are moving along that multicultural arc of justice. Barack Obama will be sworn in with his hand resting upon one of two historic sacred books, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Bible and Lincoln's Bible. King's daughter, Bernice, notices this image of these two Bibles with much appreciation and lifts up the remembrance that when her father gave his I Have a Dream speech in 1963, we could only imagine this idea that black and white, Hispanic and Asian, Jew and Christian, Hindu and Muslim could come together to give back to their communities and to each other as we can now do on yesterday's National Day of Service. And yet, his son, Martin Luther King III, laments that the dream his father envisioned has not yet been fulfilled. MLK III will be in attendance at tomorrow's inaugural event, hoping that experiencing the various layers of symbolism, the nation will be inspired. Martin Luther King Jr. was himself first inspired by the strong pastorate of his own father. One historian describes that time in an age when whites viewed black neighborhoods as hellholes of vice and social disorganization, Daddy King's church stood like an anchor in a stable and respectable community. And in a dominant culture that stereotyped blacks as childish, syncophatic clowns, King's father prided himself on being the equal of any white person. In his own strong academic training, in which he would complete a PhD in systematic theology at Boston University, King acquired a team of living souls, some having come before, some of present day. Early on as an undergrad, he was influenced by Henry David Thoreau and the intellectual theory of nonviolence and resistance. Then upon attending seminary, he would discover the wealth of social philosophers, including Locke and Mills and Hegel. He was greatly moved by one of my own favorite practical theologians, the early 20th century social gospel minister and pacifist, Walter Rauschenbusch. King felt the influence of the 19th century idealist philosopher Josiah Royce. Josiah Royce, who was originally from Grass Valley, California. And it was Royce who actually first used the term beloved community. And he did so as a concept for the future where nonviolent justice exists and where reconciliation is complete. And it was the radical abolitionist Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, who first gave rise to what later became King's popular and oft-used contemporary quote, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." MLK first learned about, wrestled with, then finally came to embrace the theories and techniques of Satyagraha, the passive political resistance that was promoted by Mohandas Gandhi. And in fact, in 1959, he would visit Gandhi in India, and really fully integrate his many influences into King's ministry, the virtue of peace that Roy talked about. And he would do that with his work, his ministry with Black Americans. King came of age at a critical and pivotal time in our country. It was the beginning of the civil rights era. Many folks, especially those living under great oppression in the South, were motivated and organizing to take on the many daily and all-encompassing injustices of the ubiquitous Jim Crow laws, which, because of our work now, we've become even more familiar with them. One of those dedicated leaders was seamstress and wife Rosa Parks. Rosa had been an active member of the NAACP since the 1940s, and she had been involved with many things, including voter registration. She had led the youth council of the NAACP. She had been an investigator of a horrific abduction and rape case. All these things before she made the decision to not give up her seat in the middle of a Montgomery bus. In fact, it was Rosa Parks' status as a respected woman in the community that helped fuel the legal defense of the Montgomery bus boycott. And it was at the beginning of this movement that launched the then newly ordained 26-year-old pastor to help lead this boycott effort. Can you imagine when we think of Martin Luther King Jr.? He was 26 years old when he was called upon to help lead that effort. And he was then, at that time, testing his still hesitant theory of nonviolent protest. Another name, Thurgood Marshall, who would become the first African-American Supreme Court justice, was the great-grandson of a slave born in the West Congo. Marshall's grandfather was also a slave, and his father, a railroad porter, and his mother, a teacher. Thurgood Marshall attended Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, and he attended at the same time as Langston Hughes and Cab Calloway. After being denied admission, this sounds familiar, right? We've heard this before, because of his race, to his hometown's law school at the University of Maryland, he attended Howard University School of Law. 3 years later, Thurgood Marshall would successfully represent his client, ending segregation at the University of Maryland. Marshall argued more cases in front of the Supreme Court. So when he was an attorney working for the NAACP, he argued more cases in front of the Supreme Court than any other attorney. And he also argued the very famous case Brown versus the Board of Education, in which separate but equal schools were declared unconstitutional. Let's add more names to our history. The Little Rock Nine. They were the first African-American high school youth to attend the previously all-white Little Rock Central High after the Brown versus Board of Education became law. Because of the outright physical hatred and the passive, the National Guard was there, but they stood and did not protect these students who were coming into the school. President Eisenhower had to call in the 101st Airborne Division to protect them. Now, across the country, closer to home, nonviolence was used as a principle for workers and immigrant working conditions. Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez together co-founded the United Farm Workers. They would advocate for higher wages, they would encourage Mexican Americans to register to vote, and they would use nonviolent methods of boycott and striking. And one more thing for our timeline. Can you think of something else big that I left out? I'm going to give you a clue, okay? So you're like, well, lots of things probably. Something big, something close to home that was established in 1954. No. Is Betsy here today? Our church was established in 1954, partially to have a place to welcome and endow our children with liberal religious education, and partially in taking a stand for those who were not willing to sign the McCarthy-era loyalty oath at the First Unitarian Church of Oakland. Star King Unitarian Fellowship was born. So we are part of this. And now, here we are, having been for many years an established teaching congregation, fortunate to have helped birth into religious leadership that would begin in our pulpit an African-American minister. We are beginning to live out the principles of multicultural, multiracial congregations by desegregating our congregations and allowing faith to be an avenue for healing, to make room so our spiritual homes can begin to be the world we dream about, where we can begin to see glimpses of that beloved community that we lift up. We then provide a powerful witness, not only in stepping out to live the legacy of Dr. King, the civil rights leader, but we provide a powerful witness in hearing the story of this Dr. King, our intern minister, this Dr. King MD. Did you know that Roy is an MD? He's an MD. Yes. Yes. Our Dr. King Jr. You can make whooping noises. Here, where we provide a safe place for him to grow into his new vocation, his fresh calling, where in telling his story, he deals out to the people his life, as Emerson would say, his life passed through the fire of thought. For each of us, there comes a point in our development where we must venture beyond our comfort zone, open ourselves to the vulnerable place to find that leadership core. This work is not yet done. The dream is not yet fulfilled. Yesterday, civil rights icon, now Representative John Lewis, do you remember John Lewis from the civil rights days? Well, I happened to hear about this, a Rush Limbaugh. I don't even know if I should bother telling you the story. He said something quite foolish, representing the civil rights movement, where he suggested that blacks would have avoided being the victims of violence if they had just had guns. I mean, I find this interesting, right? Because if it were me, I would have just shaken my head to say, you know, something under my breath. But John Lewis responded. And so I'm going to read to you how he responded. Our goal in the civil rights movement was not to injure or destroy, but to build a sense of community, to reconcile people to the true oneness of all humanity. African Americans in the 60s could have chosen to arm themselves, but we made a conscious decision not to. We were convinced that peace could not be achieved through violence. John Lewis was hit badly in the head at one of these events, so I think that's also important to remember that when he had a serious head injury. He says, violence begets violence, and we believe the only way to achieve peaceful ends was through peaceful means. We took a stand against an unjust system, and we decided to use this faith as our shield and the power of compassion as our defense. And that is why this nation celebrates the genius and elegance of Martin Luther King Jr.'s work and philosophy. Through the power of nonviolent action, Dr. King accomplished something that no movement, no action of government, no war or legislation or strategy of politics has ever achieved in this nation's history. It was nonviolence that not only brought an end to legalized segregation and racial discrimination, but Dr. King's peaceful work changed the hearts of millions of Americans who stood up to justice and rejected the injury of violence forever. So now I'm going to bring us back into that historical timeline. 1967, November. Martin Luther King was probably singing Precious Lord. He was tired. He kept up that uncomfortable mission. So I'm just going to ask you again to help me remember what was going on that summer. The summer, 1967.
Summer of Love.
Summer of Love. Riots in Detroit. That was my hometown. I remember those. Washington, D.C. The war was raging. Thurgood Marshall was confirmed as the first African-American member of the Supreme Court. The Montgomery Pop Festival. The Doors' self-titled album, the Vietnam War, and those speaking up against it. So, at the National Labor Leadership Assembly for Peace, King spoke, November. He said, "When I first decided to take a firm stand against the war in Vietnam, I was subjected to the most bitter criticism by the press, by individuals, and even by some fellow civil rights leaders. There were those who said that I should stay in my place, that these two issues did not mix, and I should stick with civil rights. Well, I had only one answer for that, and it was simply the fact that I have struggled too long and too hard now to get rid of segregation in public accommodations, to end up at this point in my life segregating my moral concerns." He says, "And I made it very clear that I recognized that justice was indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And then there are those who said, 'You're hurting the civil rights movement.' One spoke to me one day and said, 'Now, Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to agree more with the administration's policy? I understand that your position on Vietnam has hurt the budget of your organization. And many people who respected you in civil rights have lost that respect. And don't you think that you're going to have to agree more with the administration's policy to regain this?' And I had to answer by looking that person in the eye and say, 'I'm sorry, sir, but you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of my organization or by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but a molder of consensus." What others have been our leaders, our heroes, our molders? You may lift up those names as they come to your mind. Arthur Ashe. Medgar Evers. Thomas Stark King. Mother Teresa. I missed something over here. Harvey Milk.
LBJ.
Bobby Kennedy.
Eugene McCarthy.
Oprah Winfrey. Fannie Lou Hamer. I'm going to name. John Lennon?
Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter. Why not add our own names to that list? James Reeb, thank you.
Mary Elizabeth Turner.
Are we coming now into our time? Those folks who have inspired you and led you to this place right now, right here?
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama.
Corey
and I
Booker.
Miss Cory Booker.
Lee Williams.
Lee Williamson.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Obama.
Michelle Obama.
Obama. Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton. And we can keep going. I miss one more.
Bill and Jean Gaylord.
Okay, we're getting closer. Here we are.
Bob Britton.
Frank Burton.
Betsy Dye.
Jim Forsythe. Yeah. Roy King Jr.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Me.
Yeah.
You. I love it. Why not consider how we can and are stepping out to become genuine leaders, heroes, to become the molders of consensus? Keep it going, if only quietly in your mind or over the tops of the hymns. May it be so. Blessed be, and amen.